History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to do something about it. Take a little initiative, ask a few questions, then, this is important, have the patience to listen as long-buried memories come to the forefront once more. As we mark Christmas this weekend, we're going to make that the theme of this episode. But before we dive into some Christmas memories from World War II and hear what the President of the United States had to say on some of these very same airwaves 80 years ago, I had a chance this past week to visit the Kern County World War II Veterans Memorial in Bakersfield, California. It was dedicated just 2 weeks ago, and it is spectacular. The realization of a dream for a World War II veteran you met on Hometown Heroes a few months back, Walter Granger. And I just want to say congratulations to Mr. Granger, to his committee, and to all who donated to make that memorial possible. It is a beautiful tribute to not only those who made the ultimate sacrifice in World War II, but also to their families who suffered such great loss. At the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. this week, another dream was realized with the unveiling of the newly restored Circle of Remembrance featuring the inscribed text of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's famous D-Day prayer. I can't wait to see it the next time I'm in Washington, and I'm thankful that so many vets visiting our nation's capital through the Honor Flight Network will get to take that in. We have heard that speech on Hometown Heroes a time or two, but today we're going to hear one I had never heard until this week, when a Hometown Heroes listener in Connecticut sent me an article about it. 80 years ago this weekend, America had been engaged in World War II for a little more than a year, and the president went on the radio with his annual Christmas address.
It is not easy to say Merry Christmas to you, my fellow Americans, in this time of destructive war. Nor can I say Merry Christmas lightly tonight to our armed forces at their battle stations all over the world, or to our allies who fight by their side. Here at home, we will celebrate this Christmas Day in our traditional American way, because of its deep spiritual meaning to us, because the teachings of Christ are fundamental in our lives, and because we want our youngest generation to grow up knowing the significance of this tradition and the story of the coming of the immortal Prince of Peace and Goodwill. But in perhaps every home in the United States, sad and anxious thoughts will be continually with the millions of our loved ones who are suffering hardships and misery, who are risking their very lives to preserve for us and for all mankind the fruits of his teachings and the foundations of civilization itself. The Christmas spirit lives tonight in the bitter cold of the front lines in Europe and in the heat of the jungles and swamps of Burma and the Pacific Islands. Even the roar of our bombers and fighters in the air and the guns of our ships at sea will not drown out the messages of Christmas which come to the hearts of our fighting men. The thoughts of these men tonight will turn to us here at home around our Christmas trees, surrounded by our children and grandchildren and their Christmas stockings and gifts, just as our own thoughts go out to them tonight and every night in their distant places. We all know how anxious they are to be home with us, and they know how anxious we are to have them, and how determined every one of us is to make their day of homecoming as early as possible. And above all, they know the determination of all right-thinking people and nations, the Christmases such as those that we have known in these years of world tragedy shall not come back again to beset the souls of the children of God. This generation has passed through many recent years of deep darkness, watching the spread of the poison of Hitlerism and fascism in Europe, and the growth of imperialism and militarism in Japan, and the final clash of war all over the world. Then came the dark days of the fall of France, and the ruthless bombing of England, and the desperate battle of the Atlantic, and of Pearl Harbor, and Corregidor, and Singapore. Since then, the prayers of good men and women and children the world over have been answered. The tide of battle has turned, slowly but inexorably, against those who sought to destroy civilization. And so on this Christmas Day, we cannot yet say when our victory will come. Our enemies still fight fanatically. They still have reserves of men and military power. But they themselves know that they and their evil works are doomed. We may hasten the day of that doom if we here at home continue to do our full share. And we pray that that day may come soon. We pray that until then, God will protect our gallant men and women in the uniforms of the United Nations, that he will receive into his infinite grace those who make their supreme sacrifice in the cause of righteousness, in the cause of love of him and his teachings. We pray that with victory will come a new day of peace on earth, in which all the nations of the earth will join together for all time. That is the spirit of Christmas, the holy day. May that spirit live and grow throughout the world in all the years to come.
President Franklin D. Roosevelt, 80 years ago on Christmas Eve, 1942. 2 years later, of course, is the Christmas-connected World War II battle that's received more attention than most others over the years, the Battle of the Bulge. Don Cooley of the 106th Infantry Division was one of thousands who were taken prisoner during the Bulge.
Do you know why they called that thing the Battle of the Bulge?
Why don't you explain it for us?
Well, you have to visualize the result, and that is the Germans pushed in, and they pushed in right where we were, right in the middle of it. Somehow we got energized, and it was also the forest. So the Germans said, well, why mess around with these? We'll just go around them. And so that they went around us and took 6,000 prisoners from our division and went around us, and they were headed for Antwerp because that was what the Allies needed so badly to get supplies up. And they made this huge bulge in the battle line and were stopped, fortunately. And that's how it got its name. The press, you know, called it, this is a bulge, and that's what it is.
Yeah, and you said fortunately they were stopped, but that came at a heavy, heavy cost in American lives. And I'm interested in those few days now before your life really changed. So you said you get there at December 11th, the Ardennes Forest. What was your job, or what did you understand your duty to be?
Well, I was a battalion clerk. When we moved up, the battalion commander was in the Siegfried Line. We were at the Siegfried Line, which were these big cement encasements they built after World War I, and it was the headquarters for the battalion. And so my job was working with him and doing the morning report and all that sort of stuff. And so we were moving forward. We advanced forward, but the Germans were there. And in fact, the unit I was in, the immediate group of men, we didn't fire a shot because our regimental commander notified that we were to give up, break up your rifle. And it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon in December. It gets dark at that. And so the Germans were in such a hurry to come and infiltrate and take us prisoners because of that, I think, that they didn't search us very closely. And I had a baby Brownie camera in my car. How I happened to have that with me at that time, I don't know. But I've got that yet, and I'll show it to you.
Well, and some of the pictures that camera took, you still have. They're incredibly well preserved. And we'll put some of those up at hometownheroesradio.com. But I'm trying to understand what it must have been like for you. You're not quite to your 21st birthday. It's just a couple weeks before Christmas. You haven't even experienced combat yet. And you're being told before you guys even put up a fight, you have to surrender.
This particular location in the forest where we were, yes.
And that was the 423rd Regiment, is that right?
That's correct. So, Headquarters Company, 423rd.
Headquarters Company, 423rd Regiment. So how did that compute in your head? I imagine that had to be kind of hard to swallow or come to grips with.
Oh, we were just PO'd. You know, for gosh sakes, you know, get us, keep moving back through their lines where they had soldiers coming up, some horse-driven vehicles, and here we are, a long chain of prisoners.
And, you know, for those who are hearing this for the first time, maybe they're saying, well, why did they have to surrender? Why did their commanding officers give that order? Can you explain that?
Yes, I think I can. They wised up to the fact that they were completely cut off from the 3rd Regiment of our division back at St. Vith. This was agreed. And we were out of communications with some of them. They did it as, I'm sure, it was just to save lives.
That's what I really wanted to know. Because of the positioning of the German troops, had your regiment tried to fight, it would have just resulted in more lives lost. And whoever was left standing would end up prisoners. But there was no hope of breaking out of that and reconnecting the lines.
That's what these regimental commanders decided. In my company was the son of our regimental commander. You can imagine how that make him feel. I think that was a bad mistake for the Army to have a relative under the command of a top general.
So he took the brunt of all the criticism of his father?
He broke down practically. He was older.
Well, what about you? How did you handle this? Because I'm sure you never anticipated it when you were going overseas.
Well, of course not. We just handled it because it happened. And fortunately, there were several of us who were good friends that were together. And so we were all just terribly disappointed. I know that doesn't sound strong enough, but, you know, we're young kids.
Well, and now you know with 75-plus years of hindsight what the next few months would be like for you. But do you remember at the time trying to figure out what kind of future you were looking forward to?
No. We were just trying to keep dry because it was rainy and the snow was melting that day and feet were probably wet and cold and we were hungry.
And what did the Germans do with you?
They marched us for 2 days. They put on a train that had brought soldiers up to the front. These were boxcars, these 40 and 8. 40 men and 8 horses. I guess is what that came from. And so 3 or 4 days later, they got us into these trains and locked the doors and started east.
Did you have anything to eat during that time?
Yeah, I think we had, usually it was potato soup. I had kept in the pocket of my big heavy overcoat a D-ration, which is chocolate bars, which is the smallest volume, more energy than anything that we were issued. Not by the Germans, and I just had it with me because the last couple of days, we were on foot in the forest and not back in the cement headquarters. Then once we got on the boxcar, my notes would tell when we got food or didn't. But I think each day we got potato soup or something they opened up and gave us a little and probably poured it into our steel helmets to drink out of, which we had used for other things while sequestered in the boxcar. My job is a battalion clerk. I happen to have in my pocket another blank sheet called a morning report where you list the names of everybody. And so I passed this thing around the boxcar and had everyone sign it that was in there. I think there were 60 of us then. The third day we were strafed because the boxcars were not labeled. And these were, we think, British plays. So they opened the doors and we got out to dive in the ditch. Yeah, it was cold by then. But the point I want to make is that they did run along this train, long train, and open up the doors when the strafing occurred. The trouble is, strafing's over before they could get to two or three cars.
And when you say these boxcars aren't labeled, what you're saying is if they had said POW on the top.
Red Cross. Yeah.
Then the planes would have known not to shoot.
That's right.
But they don't know.
They don't know.
And so you guys are helpless inside this boxcar, and if they don't open the doors, you're going to have a lot of guys die.
That's right, or you hope that pilot is a bad shot. Some guys took off at that point and didn't come back to the boxcar.
Did you think about trying that?
Not a bit.
Why not?
Well, I think it was because if I had thought about it, I think I would have nixed it because I think it was the fourth day into Germany, third or fourth. That's a pretty long way to get back through the lines.
So you knew.
And even no food.
And wherever you're going to be, it's German-held territory. So the likelihood of you getting through all that and back to American territory is rough. And are you getting pretty hungry by now?
Yes.
Are you getting scared?
No, I don't think so. We were with friends. That helped so much.
Well, and you said you celebrated your 21st birthday in a boxcar. I don't think that's how most young men imagine spending their 21st birthday.
Well, I wouldn't interview very many people with that question, but I think I know the answer, so I don't need to.
Did it occur to you that it was your birthday? Did you mark the occasion?
Oh, sure. The day after Christmas.
Well, I guess I should ask you about Christmas, too, then, huh?
Well, there was a significant thing. We started singing Christmas carols in the boxcar. And I get emotional about that. There was another fellow among our group, had a good voice and knew the words. But pretty soon other people chimed in. And the irony, of course, is that that's a German carol, Silent Night.
So you're somewhere in Germany, you're prisoners in a boxcar, freezing and starving.
Well, we weren't freezing in there. From that standpoint, we were better off than the soldiers that didn't get caught. It got down to the coldest winter to date there in Germany, and we were sheltered. And that was something to be thankful for.
But here you are, 60 GIs, singing Silent Night inside a boxcar?
Yeah. Well, it was Christmas.
How did it sound?
They didn't sing happy birthday to me the next day, but I don't think I told them anyway. They might have. You know, what do you do? You're just there all day sitting on your duff and chatting. Because we were in that boxcar for 9 days.
Well, and I imagine you've probably heard Silent Night hundreds of times in the 75 years since then.
Sure. Wonderful song.
Can you listen to it now without thinking of that boxcar on Christmas 1944?
No.
And what do you think about when your mind goes back to that moment with those
guys? Oh, I cloud up.
You might be the only one from that boxcar who's still here.
It's very possible.
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth or make it more than it was, but I can sense just from your description and your emotion that this was a real powerful moment for you.
Oh, yes.
What did it do for you?
Made me feel better, probably.
Gave you a little sliver of
and
hope.
And also, it was another bond with the others that were singing with us, which we needed at that time.
There is not a time I've heard Silent Night since Don Cooley shared that story that I have not pictured those prisoners in that boxcar. It's time for our first break, but when our special Christmas edition continues, more from the Battle of the Bulge and why a different song we hear each Christmas did not always produce pleasant memories. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.